Again, good morning. So good to have you. And this morning, we are going to look at the passage in the Gospel of John, chapter 18, verses 19 to 27. And in the last two Sundays, we have been looking at this intense portion of this last week of the last day of the life of Jesus. Intense because there are many things important that's about to happen, and you and I really have to pay attention to the what exactly Jesus is trying to communicate to us. So before we begin, let's look to God in prayer. Father, our hearts are again so thankful that we could be found in your house this morning, and we want to thank you for your grace and your mercy and your love. So much so that each time we come, we don't even realize how good we have it here in Singapore. And we just want to ask that, Lord, right this moment, you'll help us to set aside the many things that's been troubling us this past week. Just ask that you help us to focus on you. We just ask that your Spirit will speak to us in a special way so that our lives will be changed, that we'll have boldness to live for Jesus. And truly, that's our desire. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. John chapter 18, verses 19 to 27. The topic this morning will be the lamb in a kangaroo court. And I think many of you may understand the term a kangaroo court. And I'm not going to ask who doesn't, because it might embarrass you. But the kangaroo court is a court in Australia, and I'm kidding, it's not, all right? It's a term that we use to describe a court that is illegal. Illegal, right? So there are other phrases that we use. Sometimes we say a lynch mob. In the days of the cowboys, they would decide that you're guilty, whether you like it or not. And then they'll get a rope and string you up on the highest tree. That's a lynch mob. Today, we're going to find Jesus, the lamb, in a kangaroo court. Whatever for. Sometimes we leave out the last part. He did it for Peter. Because we keep seeing the denials of Jesus, of Peter, for Jesus, being interwoven, weaved into our passage for a reason. Not because Peter, and he's always a nuisance. He's always interrupting. But here, Jesus wanted us to notice that he's going through all this for Peter. And you and I know it's not just for Peter. It is for each and every one of us here. All right? Turn to the person next to you and say, Jesus did it for you. Say it. All right, doesn't that feel good? And you need to really appreciate that. It is for you. So in our last couple of studies, just to bring you up to speed, Jesus was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, brought to the house of the high priest Annas. Now, I pronounce his name as Annas. You can pronounce his name any way you like. It doesn't matter. He was the father of Caiaphas, who was also the high priest. And it was way past midnight. It was cold, and all the other disciples had fled except for Peter and John. John was allowed into the house of the high priest because for some reason he was known to the high priest. Peter was left outside, but John got him inside into the courtyard. And there in our last study, Peter denied Jesus for the first time. And that's where we continue in our study today, in the house, in verse 19, we read, meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Interesting. So here, verse 19, we begin the religious trial of Jesus. And Annas started out by asking about his disciples and his teachings. Why would the high priest asked this question. Now, you and I must not and never think that they got nothing better to say, because the high priest is a very well-educated person in the laws of Moses, and he knew exactly what to ask. So what were the intentions of Annas? I could suggest to you two. One, why was he interested to find out about his disciples? And I suggest this to you. He wanted to know if Jesus had a huge following. That means if he had many disciples, then to kill Jesus is a risky move, because these disciples may fight back, they may revolt. And in the process, Annas himself would be in danger, because if Jesus' his disciples are many and they are fierce and are fierce warriors, Annas, his own life might be in danger. That's the first reason that I could think of. The other reason is to understand if there could be a possible revolt, that Jesus is gathering all these followers. Were they trying to plan a revolt against the Roman ruler? If that's the case, then it could be a valid reason to execute Jesus. I'm going to present to you four reasons why this trial in the house of the high priest was illegal. Let me quickly run it through you. Some of you may be familiar already. Firstly, even before they brought Jesus in, they have already decided that he is guilty. He is guilty. That's illegal. Because under any law, how can you make a decision even before the trial starts? Number two, that trial for a capital crime was conducted in the night. And that's illegal. No court can function in the night to conduct a trial. And why? Because in the night, you can't find any witnesses. Everybody will be in bed. And number three tells us that there were no witnesses. They did not have any witnesses to make the charge stick. It was only after Jesus got to the house, then they started to look for witnesses. Can you imagine a trial like that, starting without witnesses, and now they are starting to look for witnesses? And those witnesses they found were false witnesses, because we find that in Matthew chapter 26, verses 59 to 62. Verse 59 reads, "The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus, so that they could put him to death. But they did not find any, though many false witnesses came forward. Finally, two came forward and declared, 'This fellow said, I'm able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.' Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, 'Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?'" Couple of problems here. The witnesses, the statement itself was not even accurate, because that was not what Jesus said. Number two, the high priest quickly jumped in and said, "What are you going to say to these charges? You have to say something, because this guy is saying, you're a terrorist. You're going to destroy the temple. You're going to be a suicide bomber or what?" That was what he was trying to say. And you and I know that Jesus never said that, that was not what he meant. And these are all false accusers. And strangely, you and I know that in the law of Moses, you need to have two witnesses, which is correct. At least two witnesses. But if these two witnesses are proven to be false, then they must be punished. But they were not. The fourth and final reason I could think of, and it is important, and that is that the claims of Jesus were never investigated. They did not even try to investigate to find out if the law, what the claims of Jesus, and put it side by side with the writings of Moses, were they accurate? No, they did not investigate. They were not interested. They only charged him with blasphemy, and they pronounced him guilty. So we see here the intention of Annas really was to trap Jesus. Whether Jesus was planning a revolt, and during that time, there were many people who were revolting against the rule of the Romans. And for one, there is this group called the Zealot, Simon the Zealot, who was one of the disciples of Jesus. And you and I know that it is not unusual that if there is an occupying power, there will be resistance from the people. So Annas was trying to trap Jesus. Where are they? Who are they? Tell us about it. But he hasn't got any proof at all that Jesus and his disciples were a threat to the Roman Empire. The second thing he asked was about his teaching, his doctrine, implying that the teachings of Jesus were dangerous. Not so much that it contradicted the Mosaic law, but that the teachings were to incite violence and revolt against Caesar. And you and I know that that's not true. That's why Jesus replied in verse 20, John chapter 18, and verse 20 reads, "I have spoken openly to the world," Jesus replied. "I always taught in synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret." It's clear here. Jesus said, everything I said, it's all done publicly in the streets and on the mountainsides and in the synagogues and in the temple. And all, even the ordinary people, including your religious leaders, they've heard every word I said. But I think that's not all that we can get from this verse. Because in a strange way, verse 20 reminded us of another verse in Isaiah 45, verse 19. Let me read to you. Isaiah 45, verse 19 reads, "I have not spoken in secret from somewhere in a land of darkness. I have not said to Jacob's descendants, 'Seek me in vain.' I, the Lord, speak the truth. I declare what is right." That was what Yahweh said to Judah. And in an interesting way, there are so many similarities with John 18:20. Yahweh himself said, I spoke nothing in secret, neither did I speak something in some dark corner, and I didn't ask Judah to come and look after me when they cannot. They can't find me. They can't know me because I've spoken publicly. And here we find Jesus. He spoke just like his Father. Publicly, nothing in secret. And I'm quite amazed by this, because this is another principle that you and I need to remember. That you and I, we must learn to speak like our Father. You and I, we must learn to speak like Jesus. And if we can learn to speak like Jesus, let me tell you, you will never, never be wrong. But the question is, how? How can I speak like Jesus? And all of you already know the answer. You say, Pastor John, you've said that a million times. I'm going to say it one more time. The only way to speak like Jesus is study His Word, because that's where you can find the mind of Jesus. But I think the real question is this. The real question is, when was the last time you sounded like Jesus? When was the last time you sounded like Jesus? And if you keep deceiving yourself, thinking that, man, I look like Jesus, I walk like Jesus, I talk like Jesus. But you need to ask Jesus Himself, Lord, what do you think? Because that's more important. It's not important what I think. It's more important, what do you think Jesus would say to you? Do you talk like Him? Verse 21 reads, why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said. Now those three words were amazing. It is not even common. Jesus said, why question me? It's so clear. If you need to know, then ask those who have heard me. Surely they know, and they can tell you what I said. And I can tell you that this three words, why question me? This is one of those many, many questions that Jesus often asked. These are the types of questions when Jesus asked, they never fail to pierce their hearts, because it spoke right to them. It may at first sound like a rebuke to the high priest that he didn't do his homework to check the facts before bringing him in. But I prefer to think that our master teacher, Jesus Himself, here, He was exposing Annas. He was exposing Annas to be a hypocrite. It is as if Jesus was saying, why do you, the high priest, pretend to be ignorant of what is common knowledge among the people? You already know. Why are you asking again? Annas was a hypocrite. That was why, in verse 22, we read, when Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby struck him in the face. Is this the way you answer the high priest? He demanded. Now, many of us would think that the official struck Jesus because it was kind of a rude. It would appear that he struck Jesus because Jesus answered a question with a question. But that wasn't the case. The official struck Jesus for a very good reason, because he himself understood exactly what Jesus just said. He understood that Jesus was calling the high priest a hypocrite. Another thing of interest is the word struck. Struck. The word struck in Greek is rapisma. Rapisma. It means a sharp blow with a stick or the palm of the hand. It's kind of like a slap. Either the palm of the hand or with a stick. And what is interesting is this word only occurred 3 times in the New Testament. John 18:22, and then later on we'll read again in John 19 verse 3, and only used once in Mark chapter 14 verse 65. Only 3 times it was used. And every time when it was used, it is used in reference only to Jesus being struck just before his crucifixion. And we may conclude from this that it has something to do with rejection. And yes, it is a rejection. And it is also a fulfillment of a prophecy. A prophecy in Micah chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. Let me read to you. Micah chapter 5, verse 1 reads, "Marshal your troops now, city of troops, for a siege is laid against us. They will strike Israel's ruler on the cheek with a rod. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times." Now, clearly, this is a messianic prophecy, not just about the Messiah, but where he's going to be born. Because in Israel, there are 2 places called Bethlehem. Where he was born is called Bethlehem Ephrathah. And out of which will come the ruler over Israel. Clearly, this is referring to Jesus. But in this prophecy, Micah also tells us that he will be struck on the cheek. So here we see a fulfillment of prophecy. And as we go along, I hope that you and I, our confidence in the Word of God will grow, because we keep seeing prophecies after prophecies after prophecies, right to the very Word. And if that doesn't help your faith, I don't know what else will do. Tell me, all right? Tell me if it doesn't help your faith to grow. If it is a prophecy that was told hundreds and hundreds of years earlier, and now it has come to pass. So verse 22 is amazing, amazing. Let's move on. Verse 23, having been struck, Jesus said in verse 23, "If I said something wrong," Jesus replied, "testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me?" In other words, if I did say something wrong against the law, tell me, show me evidence. What was it that I said is wrong? But if what I said is true, why did you hit me? Now understand this. Jesus wasn't objecting to being struck. But he was pressing home the point that the high priest was corrupt to the core. Jesus was pressing home the point that Judaism, the whole rabbinical Judaic system, It is man-made, it is empty, and it is dead. Nobody loves to hear that when they are told that your belief system is man-made, empty, can't do a thing for you. And worst of all, it is dead. Today, as we're in the last days, it is no different. The faith that we have inherited from the apostles, similarly, it has become man-made. It has become empty. And it has become dead. Many churches, that is the picture of these churches today. Another interesting thought for all of us is that we need to ask ourselves, if Jesus was hit for speaking the truth, do you and I, should we expect anything less? And the answer should be no. Jesus himself said, the world don't hate you. They hate me first. But because you look like me, that's why the world will hate you. That's why persecution will come on you. That's why you will get slapped. But some of us sitting here, you may be thinking quietly, but Pastor John, I've not been slapped. Why? Let me suggest to you, it could be because we are not speaking up the truth. It could be because we're not telling people about the truth. And the truth is Jesus. Instead, we simply choose to shut up. We simply choose to be like Peter, merging in with the crowd, warming his hand. It could be because we just go with the flow, with the rest of the world. And we ask ourselves constantly, why rock the boat? Why would you want to make an enemy? And if that's your thinking, then perhaps that's why you've not been slapped. That's why the world don't hate you. That's why you're not persecuted. Now, I'm not asking you to go around irritating people, you know, and then you say, slap me, you know. My pastor say I need to be slapped, all right? Now, if you want that kind of slap, come to me, all right? I'll give you a good one. That should wake you up, all right? But I'm really proud of all of you. Week after week, you study the word. Not only that, in your own places, many of you are sharing Christ. You're talking to people about Jesus. It doesn't matter whether they come or not. It doesn't matter. But you're talking to people about Jesus. And I guarantee you, even though they may not say it, but they hate you. All right? They hate you. Because that's something which I have experienced with my own family people and friends whom I play golf with. And they will never want to play golf with me anymore. Because usually after golf, we will sit down and during lunch, there will be many opportunities, and I'll share with them the gospel, and I'll tell them that your belief system is completely wrong. All right? It will never give you eternal life. And they will look at me and they say, okay, goodbye. All right, don't call me again. It's fine with me, but I'm so glad I had the opportunity to tell them about Jesus. Now, mind you, some people would read these verses here and think that Jesus disrespected the high priest. But it's not the case. Let me say this very carefully. Jesus had not shown any disrespect for the office of the high priest. But Jesus was disgusted with this man called Annas, because he represented the rabbinical Judaic system that has totally become corrupted and it is unbiblical. And today you and I must have the courage to speak up like Jesus when he was here. He spoke up against the rabbinical Judaic system. And today, if we have friends who call themselves Christians and they are unbiblical, would you speak up for Jesus? Would you be willing to lose that friendship, get spat on, get slapped? Would you be willing? Jesus did. Because Annas and his son-in-law, Caiaphas, they have turned the Mosaic law into a religion. A religion that teaches people, if you follow all these rituals, you will have eternal life. They have also turned it into a business that in the temple, they've profited so much from it. And it has become a family business. And this business, to safeguard this business, this is exactly what they are trying to do. To get rid of the person who has now opened up the eyes of so many ordinary people. And in verse 24, we read, then Annas sent him, still bound, to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now, Annas knows that he has been exposed. And in order to prevent more embarrassment, he didn't want Jesus to expose all the filthy and evil things he did. He quickly sent him to Caiaphas, his son-in-law, so that their evil plan to kill Jesus can quickly be accomplished. All right, at the end of verse 24, we find that the camera now changed focus to outside the courtyard. And we remember that's where Simon Peter was. In verse 25, we read, as Simon Peter stood warming himself, he was asked, "You are not one of his disciples, are you?" He denied it, saying, "I am not." I don't know whether that was how Peter said it, but I think he must have said it very emphatically, that "I am not." Now, interestingly, the opening phrase of verse 25, as Simon Peter stood warming himself, this was the same phrase repeated from an earlier verse in verse 18. And this is to help us to connect, to remind us that Peter was standing with them. Again, clearly this is God's way of telling us that Peter, out of fear for his own life, he tried to blend into the crowd. And that while standing with them, that's why those men questioned Peter's relationship, his association with Jesus. And here for the second time, Peter denied Jesus and he failed again. Did it end there? No. Verse 26 says, one of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter cut off, challenged him, "Didn't I see you with him in the olive grove?" Now, life is really funny because failure seems to come to us, not just to Peter. Failure seems to come to us in quick successions and in forms that we usually least expect. Think with me for a moment. Had Peter been arrested with Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane? Now, Peter was not just outspoken, but he was brave. At least he was bravest amongst all the others. And he was probably a tough guy. Had he been arrested, it would have been easier for him to stand bound in chains next to his master. And he may be he may be shivering. But at least standing with Jesus, he could put on a brave front. But Satan knew better. Satan is very cunning. He knew which button to press for Peter. And Peter, even though he was brave enough to swing a sword, you remember in the garden, and he missed. He managed to get the ear only. All right. He was a good fisherman, but apparently he's a lousy swordsman. He missed. He was brave, even in front of the soldiers. But when confronted by two young girls, he collapsed. He started to fear for his life. And verse 27 tells us that after the third person, probably a stranger, asked him, verse 27 tells us again, Peter denied it. And at that moment, a rooster began to crow. Fear. And if you're honest, all of us, we experience that all the time. Fear. And for Peter, that was his weakness. So before the trial of Jesus was over, Peter was over. He was finished. He was done. He completely failed Jesus. I just want to tell you this morning here that you need to know, don't mess around with Satan. He's smart. He has many tricks to take us down. And he will come to us in ways and moments when we least expect it. That's when he will get us. The same way he got Peter. Sometimes we think that I've already memorized 24 verses. I'm okay. All right? And it can all start with a smile and a high over coffee with a girl you shouldn't be flirting around with. And that coffee leads to a lunch. A lunch leads to a dinner. A dinner leads to the bed. And we think we're okay. That's when Satan would pull his best trick on us to take us down. Let me run a few things through with you, and I'm sure you will agree that many times you and I, we tend to do well in poverty, but not when we become wealthy, powerful, and famous. Is that not true? Many pastors have failed. Many of them started out in small churches and they were hot for Jesus. But when your church start to do well, became a mega church, I'm not just talking about Singapore, all over the world, it's the same. In most cases, I'm not saying all. When they become wealthy, powerful, and famous, They think that they are above the law. And that's why many of us are not Jobs. God knows we cannot handle money. We cannot handle fame and power. But let's be happy if we are poor. Many of us tend to do well in persecutions. But when we become materialistic, that's when Satan bites us real hard. The churches in Asia here grew because of persecutions. But in Singapore, we're all struggling to even to make sense. Why would I come to church on a Sunday morning? And if that's your question, I guarantee you, you won't be around here for very long. Why are you even here in church? Because we have a lot of stuff. And that's Satan's way of taking us down. I'm not asking for persecutions again, all right? Okay, while it is good, you need to strengthen your walk with Jesus. Next, we tend to do well with an ordinary face. But when we become talented, American Idol, Singapore Idol, or when we are good looking, that's when we have to watch out. We tend to do well with strangers. We can talk to them about Jesus. There's no fear, but we are ashamed in front of our family, friends, colleagues. There's no problem with a stranger on the streets. I can say anything into his face. After this, I don't want to see his face. He doesn't want to see my face. But when it comes to family and friends, when was the last time you spoke to a family member about Jesus? Would you be bold enough to? Because you love them. Because you know that without Jesus, they are going to go to hell for all eternity. Lastly, there are many more, but I'm just suggesting some of this for you to think about. We tend to do well on Sundays. But what about the other 6 days? Would your friends in school or your colleagues at your office, would they even think that you're a Christian? Let me tell you honestly, there are many Christians who use four-letter words as punctuation marks when they talk in their workplaces. I'm not kidding you. But on Sundays, they are leading worship. All right? What a joke. If that's your faith, you need to ask, what would Jesus say about you on the other 6 days? The devil has many tricks. He has many weapons. But you and I know it is a spiritual battle that we need to put on the armor of God. That's the only way you're going to survive. Interestingly, from this verse also, the rooster began to crow. Some of your translation, the cock crow. I'm going to take you on a very quick study on this prophecy and the probability of a rooster crowing. Stay with me. Now, I must say that in the Bible, there are not many things said about a rooster or a cock or a hen, except that you remember Jesus on his last day as he was leaving the temple, he looked back and he cried. All right. He said, if you only know that he, like a mother hen, is trying to gather his chick. But they have rejected him. All right. So there are a couple of references to rooster, to cock, to a hen. But the earliest we find is here in Deuteronomy chapter 22, verses 6 and 7. If you come across a bird's nest beside the road, either in a tree or on the ground, and the mother is sitting on the young or on the eggs. Do not take the mother with the young. You may take the young, but be sure to let the mother go, so that it may go well with you and you may have a long life. Now this, again, Deuteronomy is not talking about, you know, when they settled in the promised land. They are not there yet. They are not a kind of a farming chicken yet. But this is an important principle. But here is a mention of a bird's nest, either in a tree or on the ground. Tree, we know, is those birds that can fly. On the ground are those birds that cannot fly. All right? So there's a reference here to a command to protect the mother bird or hen if you accidentally come across them. You can take the eggs, you can take the young, but not the mother. Why? Anybody? No price. All right. This is kind of a bit of common sense. Why? Anybody? Sorry? Okay, if you don't know, then I'll tell you. The mother hen tastes terrible. No, it's not true. This is a principle because the mother can still lay more eggs. The mother can still bring up more chicks. And this is the law in hunting. If you go to in the States, I don't know whether Jonathan knows this. All right? Hunting season. If you look at a herd of deers, you don't take out the mother with the young. You shoot the male. All right. That's why today in this world, even amongst the human population, you have more females than male. All right. Because the female, if you shoot the mother, the young will die. All right. So that is a simple principle here. And God also protected the mother hen. But the next thing I'm going to say is something which we don't find in the Bible. But it is probably principles that rabbis try to draw. And I'm not saying that they are correct. All right? They try to draw from here. And they get a bit comical. Just follow me. For the Jews, for the religious people, chickens were prohibited in Jerusalem during the Holy Festivals, according to rabbinical writings. I didn't say it's the Bible, all right? Don't get me wrong. Okay. And there are a couple of things you need to know. According to rabbinical writings, this is what they say. Number one, while cooking a rooster that had swallowed an unclean insect, and that insect fell out and came into contact with the oven, then that oven becomes defiled. Alright? Okay, if your imagination is as fertile as mine, imagine a rooster going around and they eat all the funny things on the ground. Alright? And one of those insects that they have eaten is unclean to the Jew, but while cooking the rooster, that insect fell out and touch the oven, and that oven becomes defiled, cannot be used anymore. Just so some of you can follow, during holy festivals, whether Passover and so forth, they need to clean up the house make sure there's no yeast and no other unclean things. But if today, even in modern day Singapore, if you go to some of the homes of a Jew, and that's the reason why none of us would be there, because they will never invite you to eat in their house, because if you go in, you may defile their house. And the traditional ones would have two kitchens, one for the normal cooking, the other one is just for the festival. All right, so they cook everything there because it is clean, utensils, pots and pans. And in this case, they are so careful. They don't want to get defiled, because once they are defiled, they cannot participate in the Passover meal or any other religious festivals. if you're defiled. All right. So this is the first thing. All right. The second thing we need to know to a Jew is that chickens are really a big nuisance because they defecate. All right. The word defecate means poo-poo. They poo-poo everywhere. And if you step on it, if you step on their poo-poo, you become defiled. So you cannot participate in temple celebrations. That's what they think, right? So for this reason, the rabbis have ruled. And this is interestingly written in here. The references is they are here if you want to read. The word B-A-B is Babylon. While they were in Babylon, they make up all these rules, all right? They got nothing to do. 70 years, all right? They write all this in their writings, all right? The first one here says, they may not raise chickens in Jerusalem on account of the holy things. That means the sacrifices. The priests may not raise them in the land of Israel because of purity, all right? So, especially the priests, they must not have chicken. They cannot raise chicken. They can eat, all right? Because many of the priests, they love Kentucky Fried Chicken, but they cannot raise chicken, all right? That's the first rule. The second one is that a prohibition against raising chickens in Jerusalem is also mentioned in the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's quite interesting. So these are all facts. Extra-biblical, yes. Not in the Bible, yes. But this tells us how the Jews think of the chickens because of their poo-poo. Not only was this an amazing prophecy concerning Peter, fulfilled within a few hours, denied and a cock crew, but this is also about the probability. And I'm asking you, what is the probability of finding a rooster in Jerusalem during the Passover? And then having it to crow at exactly the right time when Peter denied Jesus. What is that probability? And that's amazing. And that's why when we read, Jesus says, before the cock crow, you will deny me three times. Jesus wasn't talking about 6 a.m. or what. Because what time does a cock crow? Anytime. You don't tell the cock, hey, wake me up at 6 a.m. Crow at 6 a.m. You don't do that. They crow whenever they want to. All right? And the probability of finding a rooster in Jerusalem is amazing. You will hardly find a rooster allowed in Jerusalem at this time. And that's why Jesus was able to prophesy and then to bring it to pass. All right, enough of chicken poop. I believe it was not the intention of Jesus for us to focus on the chicken. But Jesus wanted us to learn more about his love from Peter's failure. Jesus wanted us to learn about his amazing love from Peter's failure. So there are a couple of lessons that you and I can take away from his fall. Number one, from Peter's fall, you and I need to learn that as a believer on our own, we are weak. We are weak. It was only a few hours earlier that Peter had the most wonderful fellowship with Jesus over the Lord's Supper. And then he had his feet washed. And then he heard the most amazing prayer from his high priest. And finally, Peter was warned to get out of the way of God's plan. Peter was warned that Jesus must die and the soldiers are coming. Yet, he fell. We are weak. I turn to the person next to you and say, I am weak. I am weak. You must say, the way like you really mean it, all right? Okay, it's not good when somebody come and tell you you are weak, all right? That maybe sound a bit louder. All right, let's try. Turn to the person next to you and say, you are weak. You see, it sounded louder, all right? I'm weak, so soft. We are all weak, right? Without Jesus. Number two, we can learn from Peter's fall that self-confidence will lead to failures. Failures. If you're self-confident, like Peter has always been, self-confident, I can, no problem, right? Others will run away. Lord, I will not. It will lead to failure. Thirdly, friendship with the world. Peter was standing with the crowd. Friendship with the world. You will make God your enemy. If you're friends with the world, God is your enemy. That's what the Bible says. That's not what I say. Fourthly, the fear of man will put us and will put you into a trap. Again, this is not what I said. Proverbs 29 verse 25. The fear of man bringeth a snare, making us afraid of faces that we can see instead of the face that we can't see. Why would you be afraid of men? They're just like you. They will die. Like you. They are not God. But let's be afraid of God. And if you're afraid of God, you don't need to be afraid of men. And that's so, so interesting. Just need to be afraid of God. Then you won't be afraid of man. Because what is visible is only temporary. Is it not? Okay. One of these days, all of us, we're going to be John was. Alright? John was. Not you, John. I'm talking about myself. Alright? Relax. Fifthly, from Peter's fall, we need not be surprised when our good friends fail us. Our good friends will fail us. And God often allows that to happen for a reason. So that when our friend fails us, it will push us to run to Jesus. And I hope this is the attitude we get when our friends fail us. It ought to turn us to Jesus. Now, having said all this, I just want to say one thing here, and this is important, that from Peter's fall, his failure was only a representation of the fall of the other disciples. Peter is representative of the other disciples. We shouldn't look at Peter and say, man, this weak bum, no guts. He's always failing and falling. But what Peter did is exactly what will happen to us also. It's a representation of us too. And we have a word for this. It is called corporate solidarity, where one single person representing a larger group of people. Now, this word is important because we'll come back to this when we get to Thomas. Thomas was also a picture of the larger group. So bear this word in mind. And we'll come back to this. But just to summarize, Peter's three denials, we said earlier at the beginning, they were interwoven into the trial of Jesus. Because Jesus wanted us to know for a fact that it was for Peter. He did it for Peter. He went to into a kangaroo court for Peter. And he went to into a kangaroo court for you and for me. He suffered all these abuses for Peter and for you. But the story didn't end there. And I'm so glad. Because Jesus knew how broken Peter was. A big man. By now, he was so ashamed of himself. But you know what? Jesus cared about Peter. And there's one little word in the Gospel of Luke that so often we missed out. Luke chapter 22, verses 61 and 62. Verse 61, Luke chapter 22 reads, "The Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had told him, 'Before a rooster crows today, you will deny me three times.'" Verse 62, "And he went out and wept bitterly." A big, tough fisherman crying like a baby because he remembered what Jesus said and what he just did for a person he loved very much. He denied Jesus. But wait a minute. Look at 61. Verse 61 tells us, "When the rooster crowed, the Lord turned and looked at Peter." Two things here. Firstly, Jesus turned. Jesus was probably in the house near the doorway, but he could see the courtyard where Peter was. And when the cock crew, Peter remembered. But that was when Jesus turned his head. Why did he turn? Let me suggest this to you. He was searching for Peter. And the Bible says, after he turned, he looked at Peter. And that looked was not a look of accusation, not a look that tells Peter, "Peter, you're a bum, you are useless, how could you?" It wasn't that kind of look. Instead, I believe that the look that Jesus gave Peter was the assuring look of love, the assuring look of forgiveness, the look that says, "I know, it's okay, I still love you, Peter." And you know what? This verse is something which I love so much, and I've always treasured this, to know that Jesus, when I fail, he doesn't accuse me. He doesn't put me down. He would search for me and then he will look at me and say, "John, I know you messed up big time, just like Peter, but it's okay. I love you and I will restore you. Don't get overwhelmed by your failure." And this was what Jesus was trying to tell Peter. A new dawn is coming for you. I will restore you. And you and I know from history that following the resurrection of Jesus, Jesus restored Peter back into fellowship and back into ministry. And then on the day of Pentecost, it was Peter who preached the word to 3,000 and they got saved. I tell you this because wherever Peter went after that, there will be those who followed him around, and they will be teasing him, insulting him. They will be walking behind Peter and crowing like roosters just to remind Peter of his failure. And today, Satan is going to do the same for you. Wherever you go, Satan will come to you like a cock crowing, because he likes to remind us that we are failures, that we have messed up. But you know what? Jesus would say, like he said to Peter, I love you. I've forgiven you. And I will restore you, and I will empower you for the ministry, Peter. We have all failed Jesus, and we will continue to fail Jesus. There's no doubt about that. But every time you and I think of the cock crowing, you and I must be reminded, not just of our weaknesses, but of the great compassion of Jesus for us. And whenever we hear Satan standing behind us, crowing like a rooster, you and I need to run and hide behind Jesus. Because Jesus will say to us, I know, but I'm not done with you yet. And like Peter, I'm searching for you. And I will assure you that I will restore you and I will empower you. God bless.